Close your eyes for a moment. Imagine a room, small, maybe, with the harsh, low hum of fluorescent lights. They're casting these long, unsteady shadows.
Yeah, you can almost feel it.
The air still maybe got that faint, sterile smell of antiseptic. And there's this large mirror. The frame's chipped, aged. It reflects that muted light.
Like a portal, I'm asking. That's
exactly. And in that reflection, there's a young woman, maybe 16. She's smiling just faintly, and her lips are moving, whispering something only she can hear.
It's such a powerful starting image.
Feels really intimate, but also, well, profoundly mysterious.
And this isn't, you know, something from a novel or a fairy tale.
No.
It's an entry point. A key image from a really remarkable account dug out from the historical records of an old Sussex asylum.
Right.
And this deep dive we're doing, it's not about clinical diagnoses or anything like
that.
Well,
it's definitely not.
No. It's about carefully looking at what happens when one person's inner world, their really unique way of seeing reality, starts to, well, reshape the whole reality of an institution.
The whole
Yeah, it's like a living case study in how flexible shared experience can actually be.
So today we are diving deep into this extraordinary story of Alice, a young woman who for a while lived in and kind of incredibly reimagined this place called the Wonderland Ward.
Wonderland Ward, yeah.
Yeah, and that Sussex Asylum. This exploration is all about identity, perception, and the strange, really compelling ways that a shared language, a real one, can just spring up, even in the most unlikely places.
Uh-huh.
We've really dug into your sources here, trying to understand not just what happened, but the why behind it all. It's fascinating stuff.
Absolutely. Our mission today is to pull out the most crucial insights from all the material you've given us, to really understand that intricate dance between someone's personal reality and the institution's, let's say, objective framework.
That tension.
Exactly. We'll look closely at the themes of shared perception versus shared language, and that's a really key difference in her story. And we'll look at how institutions, which seem so rigid, right, so structured, how they can sometimes, maybe accidentally, become these dynamic stages for human drama.
Mm.
And we'll also get into that deep, universal human need we all have for identity, for refuge, and how Alice, in her own unique way, definitely found both.
There's a line in the sources that just jumps out, you know, it's like our guide through this whole thing. She wasn't chasing a rabbit, she was tasting a memory.
Mm, it's hard.
Right. That single sentence, that's our way in, our thread through the looking glass. It hints that her Wonderland wasn't just random fantasy.
No, much deeper.
Yeah, it suggests it was a really deep-rooted response, maybe even a carefully built refuge, something really personal driving it. The arrival in a crumbling Wonderland. Okay, let's start at the start. Let's set the scene for Alice's arrival. The story kicks off early 1970s. A 16-year-old girl walks into a locked ward.
Right.
And this ward wasn't some grand, imposing building. The sources call it a crumbling Sussex asylum.
Crumbling, yeah. That word paints a picture.
It really does. It immediately gives you the specific feeling, doesn't it? You can almost feel the damp, maybe smell a bit of decay, hear echoes in corridors with peel and paint.
Definitely.
It almost feels like the perfect backdrop for, well, for reality to feel a bit loose.
Oh, absolutely. The environment is so crucial here. This wasn't some shiny modern facility. The records show a place that was already kind of fighting its own decay. You know, a crumbling ward.
Yeah.
Where the physical state might have mirrored a certain institutional tiredness of that era. And Alice arrives, speaking in riddles.
Right away.
Immediately sets herself apart. But even more striking, she refuses point blank to give her real name.
That's huge.
It is. It's not just a quirk. It's her first immediate, profound act of defiance. Her first step in claiming a new identity, opting out of their story for her.
Rejecting their label.
Totally. She's not just refusing a name. She's maybe refusing a past, a label they want to pin on her. Choosing to build her own reality, right from minute one.
And speaking in riddles, I mean, especially in a place that's all about clarity, diagnosis, control,
yeah,
it feels like a direct challenge, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
It's like a coded language, a deliberate way of confusing things, shifting the burden of understanding onto them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a powerful way to assert her unique view, like saying, my world runs on different rules. And then refusing her given name, it's fascinating. What's behind that beyond just defiance?
Well, her refusal of her given name and then immediately taking up Alice, it's way more than just defiance. It's really the foundation stone of her building this new self.
Okay.
Think about it. In a system that's designed to categorize, to label, and often maybe without meaning to kind of diminish individual will.
Yeah, to put you in a box.
Exactly. Alice's act of renaming herself becomes this profound assertion of agency. It's her immediate attempt to carve out a refuge, a psychological safe space.
A sanctuary.
Right. The sources suggest that by taking the name Alice, she's stepping into this ready-made story, this framework that gives her structure, a role, a sense of owning herself. It reminds us, like that note about real Wendy, you know, official records can freeze a life at one point.
But life keeps moving.
But Alice's life was actively moving into this new, self-defined space, leaving the official label behind. She was consciously choosing a new identity right from the moment she walked in.
So the physical decay of the asylum itself, it becomes this sort of blank canvas, or maybe a stage that was already kind of set, ready for her internal world to project onto.
That's a great way to put it.
The sources paint such a good picture of this crumbling ward, suggesting this atmosphere where maybe the usual rules of reality just fell a bit frayed.
Wow.
Like the chaos outside almost invited a different kind of internal order to step in.
Absolutely. The physical environment, the very real disrepair, it could easily have contributed to an atmosphere where the edges of conventional reality felt less sharp, less fixed.
That makes sense.
And it raises a really interesting question for us, looking back at these records.
Right.
How does that external chaos, a system struggling, maybe mirror or even invite someone's powerful internal reimagining?
Right.
In a place like that, where the structure is already kind of weak, maybe a strong internal story finds less resistance, less friction to take root, and even, well, flourish.
Well,
so it created this fertile ground, maybe unconventional but fertile, for a new world defined by her to emerge, a world separate from and maybe even more coherent to her than the official crumbling one around her.
So her wonderland wasn't just in her head.
Not entirely, no. It found echoes in the actual walls of her new home, populating her wonderland. The role mapping.
Okay, so Alice settles into this crumbling place, and then she starts doing something really fascinating, something that kind of laid the groundwork for everything that followed.
Mm-hmm.
She started mapping the people around her, you know, the staff, other patients, onto characters from her own internal story, her wonderland.
Casting the play.
Exactly. It's like she was meticulously casting a play, assigning everyone a specific role, a script, placing them inside her logic.
And this role mapping, according to the sources, it was incredibly specific.
Yeah.
It really seems to reflect her sharp observations of how they behaved, just filtered through her unique lens.
Okay.
So the White Rabbit, for example, was tagged as a panicked orderly.
Huh. Okay.
The Queen of Hearts was identified as a matron with a cruel streak.
Ooh. Tells you something.
It does. And the Mad Hatter was described simply as a silent elderly patient.
Interesting.
These weren't just random labels. They were pointed interpretations.
Yeah.
It shows how perceptive she was, just recontextualizing their core traits within her own powerful framework.
So she wasn't just naming them.
No, she was giving a narrative reason for their actions, placing them in a story she understood.
Let's think about that White Rabbit for a second. You know, someone always late, always rushing, a bundle of anxiety, always checking their watch.
Yeah, you can picture it.
To see an orderly, maybe totally overwhelmed, understaffed in that light, panicking, always behind, rushing from task to task, it must have made perfect sense to Alice.
Right.
It's a really astute observation, just seen through her particular filter. A clever, maybe even comforting way for her to categorize and understand all that chaotic energy around her.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't just slapping a name on them. She was giving a coherent story for why they acted that way, which for her was probably more meaningful than just orderly.
Exactly. And then you've got the Queen of Hearts, the matron, with a cruel streak.
Yeah.
That immediately paints a picture of an authoritarian figure, right?
Yeah.
Someone who really uses their power arbitrarily, perhaps without much empathy.
Yeah, you can see how that label sits.
By calling her the Queen of Hearts, Alice kind of defined this matron's power.
Mm.
And importantly, her own relationship to it. She turns this abstract, possibly scary authority figure into a recognizable archetype from her own world.
Which maybe made it more manageable for her?
Perhaps. It let her understand and maybe even handle the power dynamics in the ward on her own terms. And the Mad Hatter, the silent elderly patient, that fits perfectly too.
How so?
Well, it evokes this sense of quiet eccentricity. Someone who watches but maybe doesn't engage in the usual way fits right into the whimsical but also slightly unsettling logic of Wonderland.
Okay.
This specific role mapping gave Alice this profound sense of psychological control, really, in a place that was otherwise pretty uncontrollable for her.
So this isn't just about her own private perceptions then, it's about how meticulously she structured her entire world.
Yes, exactly.
She wasn't just assigning names casually, she was assigning fundamental roles within her personal drama, giving everyone a script, a place in her story as it unfolded, which creates this deeply personal, highly organized framework that made perfect sense to her, even if it seemed totally illogical to everyone else at first. It became her lens for everything.
And this concept ties directly, really powerfully, into those themes we mentioned. Shared delusion versus shared language, and institutions as stages.
Right.
For Alice, these roles were her reality, her complete coherent understanding of her world and the people in it. But for the staff and other patients, well, these roles would become this surprisingly functional, even compelling way to interact.
Functional? How?
Well, it raises this important, really insightful question that sources make us ask.
Mm-hmm.
Can a deeply personal, maybe idiosyncratic delusion actually become a functional, almost communal language if enough people start using it?
Wow.
Alice's case really suggests that boundary can get incredibly blurry. When someone's internal story is laid out so strongly and crucially offers a framework that makes sense to others too,
it stops being just her delusion.
It might well morph into a shared framework. Essentially, the asylum transformed into Alice's stage. Her delusion provided the script and the fact that others were willing to play their parts. That turned it into a shared, if unconventional, reality. 3, the institution's shifting response. From correction to accommodation.
Now, initially, as you'd probably expect, the doctors, the staff, they tried to do what institutions usually do, right? They tried to correct Alice.
Standard procedure.
Yeah. Their first move was to try and pull her back to what they saw as reality, to get her to drop the riddles, drop her chosen name.
Mm-hmm.
That's the default setting, the expected response when someone deviates so much from the norm, socially and psychiatrically.
Right. That initial correction attempt, it's the institution's playbook. It's core to the traditional medical model. The aim is to standardize perception, to gently, or maybe not so gently, guide people back to a commonly understood reality.
Get everyone on the same page.
Exactly. That approach is based on the idea that a shared, objective reality is the foundation for well-being, for communication. But what Alice's story really shows us is the amazing resilience, the tenacity of a deeply held subjective reality when it bumps up against those attempts.
He didn't budge.
The sources indicate those early efforts were pretty much unsuccessful in changing her core story, which tells you how deep her conviction was, how unwavering she was in her wonderland.
So the staff had a problem.
A real dilemma, yeah. Do they keep pushing with a method that's clearly not working, maybe even making things worse, or do they adapt to keep some kind of peace, even if it means stepping way outside their usual therapeutic box?
But then something really fascinating happened, kind of revolutionary almost, within those asylum walls. The doctors actually changed tactics.
They shifted.
Yeah, they started to play along. And this is where the institution itself, this rigid, top-down structure, starts to adapt to Alice's reality, not the other way around.
Which is remarkable.
It really is. It's this huge counterintuitive pivot.
Yeah.
Like, they recognize that just forcing the issue wasn't working, maybe even making things more chaotic.
Yeah, this pragmatic shift is really insightful. The records actually describe specific things they did for Alice. They gave her tea in chipped cups, you know, mimicking the Mad Hatter's tea party.
Wow, that specific.
That specific. Seems like a small detail, but it speaks volumes, right? And they allowed her garden wandering, which the sources specifically note was to keep her calm.
Okay.
So the goal clearly shifted. It went from active correction to just pragmatic management to simply anything to keep her calm.
Whatever works.
Exactly. It really shows the limits of conventional institutional power when it's faced with such an unyielding individual story. The institution basically realized that engaging with her world, instead of trying to tear it down, was actually a more effective way to keep things orderly, keep things peaceful on the ward.
A strategy born out of necessity.
For sure. But it had these profound consequences down the line.
So what does this all mean then? For how we understand institutional power versus individual agency, was this shift a real recognition that her world was just impenetrable? Or was it purely pragmatic, just about keeping order, stopping disruptions?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It almost feels like the asylum itself, which is supposed to be this place of healing and control, accidentally became the stage for Alice's play. Yeah. With the doctors, maybe without even realizing it at first, taking on supporting roles in her story.
What's really fascinating here is the implicit nod to Alice's agency, even if it wasn't intended that way. By accommodating her, The institution subtly validated her constructed reality.
Yeah, it kind of legitimizes it.
It does, and it raises that critical question about institutional power. Is control really being exerted when it subtly shifts to meet an individual's terms? It kind of mirrors, in a way, the sophisticated design of somewhere like Disney World.
How so?
Well, Disney creates this illusion of choice, of magic happening spontaneously. But it's all carefully orchestrated, right? Visitors feel free within a tightly controlled story.
Ah, I see.
Similarly, the Asylum, by playing along, seemed to give in to Alice's world. But by doing that, it actually brought her behavior into a framework they could manage.
So they still had control, just differently.
Exactly. They maintained a form of control, not by dismantling her reality, but by working within its rules, like how Disney controls the story by making you feel part of the magic. It's this really delicate balance where the lines between patient, system, reality, they just start to blur in these unexpected, profound ways.
Highlighting human resilience.
And the adaptive nature of how we interact, yeah. Fordham. The contagion of names. A shared reality takes hold.
Okay, so what happened next really shows the powerful, almost contagious nature of Alice's world. Her internal story didn't stay locked in her own head for long.
No, it spread.
The sources state it clearly, and this is a really key development. Alice began pulling others into her world. Patients started using her names.
The contagion.
This is where her inner world really starts to bleed out, becoming this shared, almost collective experience on the ward.
Yeah, this contagion of names is such a powerful, really insightful example of how shared stories can just emerge within a closed community.
Why do you think that happens?
Well, when one person provides a framework that feels coherent, even if it's unconventional, others might just find it easier to adopt than to resist, especially in a place where your own identity might already feel a bit fragile or undefined or even stripped away by the institution itself.
Right. You might latch onto something.
Exactly. For many patients, these assigned roles, these new names from Alice, might have offered a sense of identity, maybe even purpose, that their old lives or the asylum setting just didn't provide.
A new way to be someone.
Right. It speaks to that fundamental human need for meaning, for having a role, for connection, even if it comes wrapped in a fantastical package. Alice basically offered them a new lens, a new language to understand their shared life there.
So it sounds almost like a new social structure just formed organically, a new way for them to understand their interactions, the hierarchy of the ward, maybe.
That's a good way to put it.
It stops being just Alice's personal delusion and becomes this legitimate shared language in its own right. Mm-hmm. This isn't just people humoring her. It feels like a profound collective adoption that fundamentally changes the social dynamics of that community. What does that tell us about how reality gets constructed, especially in isolated groups like that?
Well, if we connect it to the bigger picture, it really demonstrates this extraordinary human capacity we have for collective meaning making. When a system, or in this case, an individual like Alice, provides a new vocabulary for things people are already observing.
Like the cruel matron.
Exactly. Like a cruel matron becoming the Queen of Hearts, or a panicked orderly becoming the White Rabbit. It can resonate deeply. It can spread fast.
Because it feels true on some level.
It suggests her mapping tapped into something already there, maybe unspoken, but felt in the collective experience of the ward. Her names gave them a shorthand, a shared understanding that maybe went beyond their individual struggles or the cold clinical language of the institution.
So it created common ground.
Yeah, this new shared language provided common ground, a way for them to relate to their environment and crucially to each other in a way that felt authentic, maybe even empowering within Alice's story.
But the influence didn't stop with the other patients, which is just truly remarkable.
No, it kept going.
The sources also suggest that even some staff, maybe without realizing it at first, started to slip into character.
That's the tipping point.
This is where the sheer power of Alice's constructed reality becomes undeniable. The boundaries between observer and participant, between objective reality and this new story, they just get incredibly blurry.
Very porous.
How did that affect the staff, their own sense of things?
Yeah, this is really where those boundaries blur completely, and it raises deep questions about influence, belief. For the staff, okay, maybe initially it was just an easier way to interact with patients who responded better to those rules.
Made the job simpler.
Could have. Might have brought some calm to a chaotic place. But that phrase, slipping into character, it suggests something deeper, right? Maybe a subconscious assimilation of Alice's world. an unconscious acceptance of its terms.
Wow.
The institution became this full-blown stage, and it wasn't just the audience, but even some of the crew, maybe the directors, found themselves getting pulled into the performance.
Unbelievable.
It really highlights the subtle, maybe almost insidious power of a consistent, compelling story to reshape even the people whose job it is to uphold conventional reality.
And our tendency to adapt.
And our tendency to adapt, yeah. To find common ground, even if that ground looks like Wonderland.
So The Asylum,
yeah.
It started as a place to correct Alice, to impose its reality, but it ended up becoming a refuge for her, shaped by her rules.
A complete inversion.
And amazingly, it was a refuge that was adopted, at least partly, by the very people meant to impose that external reality. The roles she created gave meaning, identity, not just for her, but for a whole little community. Offering this new shared lens to see their often bleak lives through, it became a living story.
Indeed. Those core themes of identity and refuge just become completely tangled up here.
Yeah.
Alice created this refuge of understanding, a framework that made sense to her, giving her a consistent sense of self that the outside world couldn't.
Right.
And others, in turn, found their own kind of refuge by participating in that framework.
They found a place, too.
Exactly. It's just this powerful testament to the resilience of the human mind, our ability to find or create meaning, belonging, even in the toughest, most restrictive situations. This communal adoption turns a personal story into a shared cultural thing within the tiny world of that ward.
It shows how much we need a story.
Individually and collectively. It wasn't just a fantasy for them. For a time, it was their operating reality. V, through the looking glass, the mirror room enclosure.
Okay, the sources describe this one particularly poignant moment, really symbolically rich. It brings us right back to that opening image we started with.
The mirror room.
Yeah. They recount how one day she asked to go through the looking glass, and true to her story, they found her in that mirror room, smiling at her reflection and whispering to it.
Such a vivid picture.
It really is. Almost sacred. It takes us right into the heart of her private world, the deep reality she'd built.
Yeah, that image of Alice talking to her reflection. It's incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
Deeply resonant. The mirror, I mean, it's such a classic symbol everywhere, isn't it?
Self-reflection, other worlds.
Duality, portals to inner spaces. For Alice, it truly was her own personal through the looking glass, a direct doorway to her inner story.
And it wasn't accidental.
No, this wasn't just a spontaneous thing. It was a conscious seeking of connection with her Alice self. Or maybe, like we speculated at the start, a conversation with some memory she was chasing.
A memory.
It represents this profound link to her self-made identity, a moment of deep, unfiltered communion with the very core of who she'd become in that place.
It's like she was talking directly to the essence of her created identity, reinforcing it, you know, solidifying it in her own mind.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like this moment of profound introspection, but entirely within her unique reality, a private ritual that just underlines how deeply immersed she was. And the fact that she asked to go there,
that's key,
suggests a conscious, deliberate journey, not just a whim.
Exactly. That conscious intent is fascinating. The asking implies this deliberate journey seeking out this interaction, which confirms the depth, the intention behind her Alice identity.
He wasn't passive.
Not at all. In the whispers, they were private, sacred to her world, suggesting that the most intimate, maybe the most fundamental parts of her Wonderland were saved for this one powerful interaction with her reflection.
Mm-hmm.
It's a moment of pure, unfiltered self-affirmation. A complete acceptance of her identity as Alice, performed in her personal sanctuary within the asylum. Almost like a self-coronation, you know?
Yeah.
Confirming her role as the queen of her own reality.
Well, as stories do, they change. Alice's Wonderland, this crumbling Sussex asylum, it eventually came to an end.
The closure.
Yeah. In 1974, the hospital closed its doors. A big external institutional change that was bound to bring this dramatic, irreversible shift to the world she'd built, the world she shared.
Mm-hmm.
It's a stark reminder, isn't it, how fragile these personal realities can be when they hit external forces you just can't control.
Yeah, that closure represents this huge, unavoidable disruption. Mm-hmm. The stage was literally dismantled, taken down.
Gone.
Alice was removed from the only environment where her unique language was understood. And more than that, embraced and even mirrored back at her. So this transition raises a really important kind of poignant question for us.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to an identity that's been so meticulously built when its whole supporting environment, its entire stage set, is just suddenly irrevocably removed?
What happens then?
The scaffolding that held up her world was just gone, leaving her in this completely different landscape where her story might not resonate, might not even be recognized anymore.
So her reality, once shared,
becomes entirely her own again, and maybe profoundly isolated because of
it. It must have been incredibly jarring, shattering almost. She didn't just lose a place. She lost an entire world she'd carefully built and, crucially, shared.
Yeah, the sharing was key.
This was a community that had, in its own way, accepted and played along with her reality. So that sudden displacement, it feels like being wrenched away from her own self, from the core of who she'd become inside those walls.
Indeed. That 1974 transfer, it marked the definite end of her specific wonderland. But not necessarily the end of Alice herself, though how she expressed herself would change dramatically. This abrupt change just highlights the fragility of these constructed realities when they face these big external systemic shifts. Her old environment, which had become the theater for her identity, was gone.
Forcing a confrontation.
Forcing a confrontation with a new reality that had no place, no roles, no understanding for her established characters and stories. It was a profound loss. A kind of narrative erasure.
Erasure.
Yeah, like that concept from Klaus Richter where the erasure itself becomes the evidence, the abrupt silence that followed. That in itself is powerful testimony to just how deep her connection was to that old environment. The silence, the enduring name.
And this brings us to the really profound aftermath of that transfer. After she was moved to the new facility, the sources tell us this stark, incredibly powerful detail. She never spoke again.
Just silence.
The riddles, the whispered talks with her reflection, that whole vibrant, if unconventional, period of expression, it all just ceased. Mm. It's such a deep silence after such a rich, compelling story. What does that tell us about identity, language, environment, how they're linked?
That profound silence, after years of this rich, deeply unconventional inner life being expressed,
yeah,
it's maybe the most striking, almost heartbreaking part of her story.
Yeah.
It strongly suggests her language, her whole elaborate narrative, was just inextricably tied to her original environment.
Mm.
And crucially, to the shared participation within it.
Without the audience, the play stops.
Pretty much.
Mm.
Without her wonderland, without her cast of characters, without her stage, the very need or maybe even the ability to speak in that specific way might have just vanished.
Wow.
It's as if removing the stage meant the play itself stopped. Leaving the lead actor without a script, without an audience, and ultimately without a voice in that new alien place, her reality no longer mirrored back, just retreated completely inward.
And what she did instead, it's equally poignant. Her new routine, they say, was to just stare out the window waiting for someone no one else could see.
Mm, that image.
It paints such a solitary, utterly heartbreaking picture. A figure just suspended between worlds, clinging to a reality only she could perceive now. Who, or what do you think she was waiting for in that constant vigil?
That posture of waiting, so persistent after the speech stopped.
Mm.
It's deeply symbolic and profoundly human, I think.
How so?
Maybe she was waiting for a memory to come back fully, or for her wonderland to somehow miraculously reappear around her, or maybe for the key, you know, to go through the looking glass one more time and reclaim that identity.
Hoping for a return.
It feels like this poignant image of inner steadfastness, even when faced with overwhelming external change, a desperate hope for the return of a world that made sense to her. It kind of echoes that idea from real-life Mario where chasing the castle changes the player first.
Yeah.
But for Alice, this new castle, this new facility, held no familiar paths, no story hooks for her. She was waiting for a return to a reality only she could see, a world where her identity mattered and, crucially, was reflected back. It suggests this deep loyalty to her lost world, a refusal to abandon the self she'd built so carefully.
In the case, despite her deep silence, despite the completely new place, the sources end with this incredibly powerful, enduring line. They still call her Alice.
Ah, yes.
That's this name, her chosen identity, her self-creation. It persisted, even in her quietness. It became this powerful legacy beyond her active participation.
That's the ultimate legacy, isn't it? The indelible mark she left, her chosen name, her created identity, it outlived her active participation. It even outlived the very environment where it was forged.
It became something else.
It became an artifact, a story passed down, a testament to the profound, enduring impact of her unique reality. It's a powerful echo of that Buzz Lightyear idea, you know?
Yeah.
Artifacts outlive their makers. And Alice became her enduring artifact. The name that just wouldn't let go of the institution's memory. It suggests her identity, once asserted with such conviction, just became indelible, a permanent part of the collective story of that place, regardless of her current state, her silence.
It speaks to the power of claiming an identity.
The enduring power of a deeply held self-proclaimed identity.
Yeah. So the name itself became more than just a label. It became a memory, a story that kept being told, acknowledged, even when Alice herself fell silent.
Mm-hmm.
It really suggests the extraordinary power of an individual's story to shape not just their own view, but the views of an entire community, lingering long after the act of telling of that story has stopped.
Absolutely. This moves way beyond delusion or language.
Yeah.
It becomes a form of indelible identity, almost mythological in a way.
Yeah.
Even in silence, she remained Alice, suggesting her self-designation became more real, more persistent than her original given name could ever have been. It's just a remarkable example of how identity, once forged with that kind of intensity and accepted by a community, how incredibly resilient it can become, leaving an imprint that goes beyond even the physical presence or active communication of the person themselves.
Her name became shorthand.
Shorthand for an entire, complex, deeply human history within those institutional walls.
Yeah.
Outro.
What an incredible, really profound journey we've taken today, diving into the extraordinary story of Alice. From a young woman just refusing her name in a crumbling asylum.
Right at the start.
To meticulously building this shared reality that eventually even the staff got drawn into. Her story just fundamentally challenges how we think about perception, about identity, and the fluid, often really surprising boundaries of institutional life.
Really good.
It's such a testament to the resilience of the human spirit, you know, to create meaning wherever we are.
Indeed. We've seen how one single person's profound inner world can actually transform an entire environment, creating this vibrant shared language where none existed before.
Yeah.
And how that identity, once claimed with such force, can leave this indelible mark. Persisting even through profound silence, it really forces us to reconsider how stories are formed, how they spread, and maybe how deeply we all need a story to live by and a place to belong within that story.
This truly unique story leaves us with a really provocative thought, I think. What happens when our environments don't just shape us, but somehow, unexpectedly, invite us to rewrite the actual rules of reality itself?
Hmm.
And then, what price do we, or does the person at the heart of that reality, ultimately pay when that carefully crafted world is suddenly irrevocably taken away?
Heavy question.
It is. Our deep dive concludes with this final lingering image. A window, a figure waiting, and the name they still use. Alice.